Welcome to RiffRam Review, your TC Sports Talk home right here on KTCU 88.7. Here are your hosts, Seth Dowdle and Ian DePicia. Welcome everybody right here to RiffRam Review on 88.7 The Choice, your choice for college radio. Ian DePicia here alongside Luke Anderson and Jackson James Boyce. How are you guys doing tonight?
We're doing all right. Some technical difficulties to start today's show, but man, we adjusted, I think, well.
Pretty good.
We got a very action-packed show today, so I can't wait.
Yeah, executing on the fly. something that I wish the Frogs could have done this past weekend.
Oh my goodness.
Nice little teaser there.
Yeah, well, no. So folks, welcome in. It's me, Ian DePicia, alongside Luke Anderson and Jackson James. Seth is not here tonight. He's dealing with a little bit of a stomach bug. So, Seth, if you're listening, we hope you're feeling better, and hopefully you can get back into classes sometime tomorrow or later this week. But, folks, we still have a fantastic episode on tap today. We're going to start off with TCU football, as we always do. And, boys, obviously, we saw the score this weekend. TCU ended up losing to UCF. What was the final score? Was it 35-34. Nice. So TCU expected to win this one. The line was kind of all over the place a little bit as we got closer and closer to this matchup. And I know all of us here in the studio expected TCU to win. That's what our score prediction said. But just very simply, Jackson, I guess starting with you, what were some of your generic thoughts, maybe right after the game ended? How are you feeling, at least?
I mean, for the first three quarters, I was feeling pretty confident, even though the game wasn't necessarily too out of hand. TCU did have that 21-point lead, I think, in the second half, or at least the end of the first half, but they still felt like they were in control of the game, and then they slowly started to lose it. But I think, first off, the start to this team, you got to credit the Frogs for getting out to a 14-0 lead early in that first quarter, and it really felt like they were feeling the energy of AMG Carter Stadium for family weekend and all that stuff, and they were really just Hoover had a great start. He had a great game overall with 400 yards passing and four touchdowns with no interceptions. But then the Frogs defense never really got a grip on the game. I mean, UCF had a total of 289 yards rushing, and that is just, you know, a recipe for disaster, because then they're going to win the time of possession, and then your offense isn't really going to have a chance to really continue their momentum, as we saw in that second half, as the Frogs were only able to score 13 points. And so that was just very disappointing from the defensive side of the ball.
Yeah, it was all over the place. And Luke, I mean, kind of switching it over to you now, I mean, again, based off of what Jackson said, I think we're all in the same kind of consensus here, is that was one of the best first halves we've seen. But then where did it go in the second, you know, 30 minutes of play?
Yeah, I mean, I was really going to touch on the good first as well, just because that's how the game kind of started out. You know, first half, the Frogs go up 28-7, you know, by half. And you're thinking, you know, like, this is exactly how you want to open Big 12 play. So I do just want to give, you know, some flowers where they're due. Josh Hoover, of course, a phenomenal game, 402 yards of passing and four touchdowns, just really cementing himself, I think, among, you know, the top echelon of those Big 12 quarterbacks. And, you know, really putting, he's third in the country in passing yardage. And you know, that was his seventh career 300-yard passing game. And he tied his career high with four touchdowns. So you really like to see, you know, Hoover blossoming and just really getting, you know, his not his feet wet, but getting comfortable in this offense. And then another guy that I just want to, you know, touch on, because he had an outstanding game, and I think he's, you know, kind of developing into our true wide receiver one, is Jack Besh. You know, 9 receptions, 200 yards and a touchdown. I think he's really showing us that he's just a big time, big play threat. He can do it all, man. He's 6'3", you know, 225 pounds. He can fly down the field. He provides a mismatch against linebackers and DBs, which is hard to do for a guy that size. So I think he had just a phenomenal game with that 50-yard touchdown in the first half. And then on a drive where TCU was up 31, or after UCF had cut the lead to 31-28, the Frogs were storming down the field, and he took a pass for about 29 yards there, and showed some elusiveness, you know, ducking a UCF defender and then you know, putting on the brakes and, you know, picking up some extra yards. So just a couple guys that I wanted to give some props to before we transition to the doom and gloom of the second half.
Yeah, it was, oh my goodness. I mean, Jackson and I were at the game together, and we were just head in hands at the end of this game. I mean, I told him it was, first of all, the environment was great. It was really hot.
It was humid.
So I told him, I was like, you know, if we're getting to this third quarter and we're up by three scores, I'm thinking about leaving. Then obviously the game got closer, and then it got closer, and then it got too close. And I guess that's kind of where we can start. Everything, again, went wrong the minute that second half got kicked off. TCU's offensive play calling just wasn't the same as it was in the first. I felt like, especially in the fourth quarter, TCU's offense got very conservative in the way they were calling their plays. There's a lot of times where TCU would start out on the back foot, very deep in their own kind of, you know, side of the field, and it would all it was all these little dump offs to the running backs on the sides or little out routes here and there, and we weren't stretching the field nearly as much as we did in the first half. And so I'm kind of sitting here not sure if this is a us problem or if UCF came out in the second half and just made all the adjustments. What do you guys think about that?
I think the big thing for UCF was they were able to come out of the halftime, have a 10-play, 80-yard drive. And they did that in, 3 minutes and 50 seconds? So it was a really smooth and efficient drive for them. RJ Harvey just ran all over us. He had a couple runs for, 10-plus, it felt like, on that drive. He had a 19-yard run to get them a first down on a big 3rd and 7. So it felt like the energy was not as you would like it for the defense, because then TCU's offense would respond with a 5-play, 75-yard drive. But then after that, UCF was really in control. On their next possession, they would punt, but then they would get a touchdown on their next one, then another touchdown, then another touchdown, and then we finally forced them to punt, I think, in the fourth quarter with 8 minutes left. So, you know, the TCU's defense really could not get a stop there for a majority of that later, or I guess middle part of that second half, because UCF was really able to overcome that 21-point deficit. And I think a huge part to it, which we could dive a little bit deeper into, is the lack of a run game for the Frogs.
Goodness,
because I think
gracious,
when you blow a big lead, like a 21-point lead, that kind of goes down to time of possession and how long your possessions are. Yeah, cool, you can score a touchdown. But if you score a touchdown in 90 seconds, that's not necessarily helping your defense out, and that's not necessarily shortening the game at all. So Cam Cook only had 35 yards rushing on 11 attempts, and then Dominic Johnson had 2 carries for 14 yards. No other Frog had more than 2 carries. So it's like we need to get kind of resemble that run game. I had big high hopes for Cam Cook, and he did not deliver. Or the TCU run offense, I would say, because it's more on the O-line and stuff and schemes. They did not deliver.
And just some raw numbers on that I've got right here. So the key to the collapse for me was that UCF stuck to their game plan and TCU did not. Just some raw numbers to kind of help support your point there. TCU ran the ball only 17 times to UCF's 54 times. We only got 58 rushing yards on 17 carries. That's 3.4 yards per carry. That's kind of just an example of, I think, the larger problem for this offensive line. It seems like the interior of this offensive line isn't getting that same push that they have in the past couple years. You know, you see guys like Brandon Coleman and Andrew Coker from the past couple years just be these stalwarts that have been there for a long time and know the TCU offense. And so you kind of take that for granted, you know, coming into a year where you pretty much have to replace 4 out of 5 positions on that offensive line. And so to see them not, you know, get that sort of push against a defensive line that, you know, credit UCF's defensive line. They got a phenomenal push all night, and Cam Cook wasn't able to get those lanes, kind of like we touched on last week. But you know, just I think the fact that 3.4 yards per carry is kind of become the trend, it seems like, in these past few weeks, where we're not able to break off big chunk plays. And Sonny Dykes said it. He said, we've got to be able to run the ball better right now. That's something that's plagued us. We've got to be able to run it better than we did today. When you can't, it's hard to hold on to a lead. That's kind of what happened to us. So, and just, you mentioned it, but just to really kind of reiterate, the drive that it really stuck out to me for, and of course, you know, you could say it about the whole second half, but I think specifically when TCU took over with the ball with 4 minutes and 37 seconds left, it was right after UCF had just come down and scored that touchdown, 34-28 lead. And TCU should have been able to lean on Cam Cook, but instead the Frogs had to attempt 3 passes. So TCU gained only 8 yards and took only 1 minute off the clock, giving the ball right back to the Frogs, to the Knights, and allowed KJ Jefferson to lead them down the field, take all that time off the clock, as Jackson mentioned, and then give the Frogs only 36 seconds to try and make a miracle happen.
I mean, I was about to bring up that exact drive or that series of plays, and it caught me off guard because there was a bunch of horrible clock management in college football this past weekend in various games. I don't know if you watched the Kansas UNLV game or Arizona Kansas State, just a bunch of boneheaded mistakes. And it felt like once Hoover attempted that first pass to Drake Dabney on that, you know, seal away drive that you would hope the Frogs would have, I was like, oh no, this is like troubling. Yeah. Because then at that point, the coaching staff, which I mean, the whole game kind of proved it, but that means they've lost like trust in the run game. And so it's like good on them for at least adjusting and not, you know, being insane and trying the same thing over and over again, but not trying it. But that's where it completely kills you, because then Hoover had a short pass to Cam Cook for 2 yards, and then Hoover completed one to Savion for 6 yards, which was short of the sticks. And at that point, I knew this was like kind of a wrap, because UCF had all the momentum at that point. If our offense can't even get one first down, because they looked in that first half so smooth, really any difficulty in terms of moving the ball down the field, like you said, Ian, moving the ball vertically. In the second half, they kind of struggled and they made it more of a horizontal game, and that's what that final drive represented, just how lackluster that TCU offense ended the game.
Yeah, it's tough, because you know the talent that this team has. You know what they're capable of. And again, I'm going to harp on what Luke said. Again, going into this season, I'm not the only person that said this. There's probably hundreds of people that said this. But again, the offensive line was the biggest red flag for me on this team. It's not only is it just new, but it's also very inexperienced, right? So you look at this offensive line and you say, hey, you know, maybe hopefully we can get some experience on there after a couple games. Maybe we can have ourselves a nice running game. Cam Cook isn't doing well right now, but I don't necessarily think it's because Cam Cook isn't good. Cam Cook is talented. Sure, he's not going to be he's not going to be one of the nation's top five running backs, top 10 running backs, but he's going to be very, very serviceable for TCU. But he needs an offensive line that can get push. And to that point, if you can't establish the rushing game, then it makes it much harder to establish the passing game, which fortunately Josh Hoover hasn't had much trouble with, but we saw it in the second half. Josh Hoover was under pressure like no other game that I've seen, the way he was under pressure in the second half against UCF. Running for his life, the pocket broke down. A guy that isn't necessarily even a pocket quarterback struggled to even find lanes to get out of, right? And again, you can have the best quarterback available. You can have the Jack Beshes, the Savion Williams, the J.P. Richardsons going downfield. If you can't give your quarterback just enough time to find those guys, then you're going to be screwed. And that's exactly what happened with TCU, right? I mean, every football game can always be kind of chopped down to some of the fundamentals. And I think the biggest fundamental was the offensive line struggling, not getting that rushing game going, and also not being able to stop the rushing game, which was really all UCF came in here for. Granted, KJ Jefferson threw the ball much more this game than he had in the previous 2 weeks with UCF. He ended up going 13 for 22 for 230 yards. 145 of those were to Kobe Hudson, who absolutely killed the Frogs' defense. He was going up against JT Broughton. JT Broughton, who I think is actually still a very good, very good corner, very good, you know, defensive player. He just had to go up against their best guy, and Kobe Hudson just had a day. Then again, RJ Harvey, 180 rushing yards, 2 touchdowns on 29 carries. You have to be able to stop that. So this is towards the end of my rant now, but on that topic, though, the run game for TCU couldn't get started, and we couldn't stop the one thing UCF came in here trying to do, which was to run the ball.
And I wanted to touch on, you know, that point you made right there about UCF coming in, and everybody in the world knows that they're going to run the ball, and they're going to run the ball as, you know, much as they'd like. You know, they came in as the second, you know, best rushing team in the country, and everybody knew that. But I think another thing that, and you started to, I think we do need to give this defense some props in certain areas, but it seems to me that we're finding kind of a theme with this particular defense under Andy Avalos, and it seems that they, at certain times, can become one-dimensional in terms of we have our guys flying around. We are so predicated on stopping KJ Jefferson, bringing him down. We, you know, we brought a bunch of delayed blitzes. We used different packages. You know, we saw Marcel Brooks getting after the quarterback. It seemed like he, now, you know, we didn't get a lot of sacks, but, you know, KJ Jefferson had to fight off a lot of this pressure. And, you know, he's just 250 pounds. And, you know, a lot of those guys are going to bounce off of him sometimes. And so he deserves the credit for escaping like all these sacks. But I think that, you know, the Horned Frogs defense put a lot of emphasis on not allowing KJ Jefferson's legs to become a part of the game. And I think it kind of took away from part of that defense focusing in on stopping the rushing attack up the middle. And so I just think that while the defense, you know, threw some exotic looks at Jefferson and made him struggle for sure, it just kind of seems like that they were a little too focused on that rather than, I guess, containing the rushing lanes as a whole.
I will say this to end off this conversation on a high note. I really wanted to go back to that final drive that TCU had. And I thought they were a couple or maybe one play away from sneaking out and kind of recovering this game. As we look at it, they got the ball with 36 seconds left. And at this point, momentum was like at an all-time low. And so for Hoover to able to rally this offense, he had a run for 10 yards on the first play, which I thought was a fantastic play by him. And then he threw an incomplete pass, but then he was able to hook up with Jack Besh for 13 yards for a first down. Then had a big play with Eric McAllister for 12 yards, and that was really able to get the Frogs in the field goal range, at least attempt area. And then one incomplete pass to JP Richardson that goes the other way, maybe a better ball, maybe a better route, something, a better connection there. The Frogs get, what, 5 yards closer, something like that. They had a timeout to use, I think. They used the timeout there. And then from our angle in the student section, it looked like he was going to be short, but it wasn't actually short. It was wide right.
Yep.
So if, you know, Lemmerman maybe has a little closer and he doesn't have to overemphasize his, you know, energy or power into the kick, maybe it's more accurate and the Frogs were able to sneak away. So as much as we want to, like, you know, dog on the offense for not having the best execution, I thought that 2-minute drive, or really 36 second drive, was successful in terms of getting into a spot to at least potentially win the game. Obviously they need to clean up some stuff there, but to being able to rally and get close to coming away with, I would think, a steal of a win at this point, because they completely gave the game away, it felt like, at that point. So hopefully they use that in terms of really getting into a flow offensively as we continue this Big 12 season.
Yeah, so TCU ends up losing this one at home at Amon G. Carter Stadium to UCF 35-34. That was on Saturday. They've got to regroup. They're 2-1 now heading into SMU Hate Week. The battle for the Iron Skillet will be going on this Saturday at 4 p.m. over at Gerald J. Ford Stadium. That's exactly what we're going to talk about in our next segment. Stick right here. You're listening to Riff Ram Review on 88.7 The Choice.
Welcome back to Riff Ram Review here on KTC, The Choice, your choice for college radio. I'm here alongside Ian Apetian and Luke Anderson. I'm Jackson James. We just talked about TCU's last game against the UCF Golden Knights. Now we're going to move on to this week's matchup as the Horned Frogs go on the road to Dallas to play the Mustangs of SMU for the Iron Skillet, as they would call it, this rivalry. This one's going to be like the last one for a while, potentially. Yeah. So there's a lot on the line for this matchup. But the Frogs look to bounce back this week. And an in-state rivalry game, they've played this game numerous times. So I want to get your guys' thoughts. Luke, we'll start with you on what do you expect for the Frogs on this Saturday?
Yeah, so I think the key to this game is really going to come down to that talented SMU defense and how they match up against this high-powered TCU offense. I think last week, you know, they're coming off SMU is coming off a pretty great, you know, showing against BYU. They lost, of course, but, you know, only allowing 18 points. Just kind of a tremendous, you know, effort from that defense of SMU. You know, they held a BYU to 2-for-13 on third down. Something that, you know, you want to kind of look out for, because TCU excelled on third down versus UCF and really has excelled on third down all this year. They were 10-for-15 on third down conversions against the Knights. So I think that that's one of the key things that you're going to have to look to. You're going to have to look to Kendall Briles, you know, continuing to make some smart play calls on third down, and Josh Hoover continuing to have no fear and to let it rip. Another thing that I do want to kind of keep an eye on, of course, with that SMU defense, though, is they did have two interceptions against Jake Retzlaff, the BYU quarterback. So Josh Hoover hasn't thrown an interception yet this year, but he does tend to get a little, not careless with the ball, but he is very risky, and that's what you love from a gunslinger quarterback in a high-powered offense like this. So just, you know, right off the top, I think this matchup is very much going to depend on how well that TCU offense is going to be able to game plan for some of those playmakers in that secondary of the SMU.
That's what I have to agree with that, because at this point, I feel like TCU's offense is the one you have to rely on in these type of matchups. And so if Hoover can go out there and kind of continue his play this season, he's been a tremendous quarterback so far in three games into the season. And so if he can protect the ball but still get the ball, you know, vertical, stretch the field like we saw in the first half against the Golden Knights, I think the Frogs will have some big success on the Saturday matchup. How about you, Ian?
Same here. I think I'm kind of in agreement, I guess, with you guys. I really want to see TCU continue to stretch the field. We stretched the field nicely against UCF. I want to see it continue, right? I don't want to just see us take the top off against one or two teams here and there. The more that TCU can stretch the field, the more of a chance I feel that the team has the ability to then open up the run game or the short to medium passing game. I want to see them do that more, establish the running game. I know we keep saying it every single week, but it's something that I feel like we just haven't been able to do. It's either been a bit of a slow start like we saw against Stanford, or it comes in waves, it comes in pockets depending on who's back there. But I want to see Cam Cook have a bit of a bounce back game. I'm really looking at him. I'm not sitting here trying to critique Cam Cook's game and say, you know, he doesn't know what he's doing, because he obviously knows. I just feel sometimes Cam Cook always tries to make cuts inside to the field. I'd really like to see him, if that opportunity arises, to bounce to the outside and maybe get a lane on the outer part of the field, because that tends to be a little more where that space is. At least it was there this weekend against UCF. We just didn't really take advantage then. Lastly, I want to see this Andy Avalos defense that we saw in weeks prior. I want to see this defense be hungry. I want to see them, you know, fight for the ball, you know, for those DBs and cornerbacks, but also bring the pressure. They're going up against an SMU team that has obviously seen some quarterback changes with Kevin Jennings coming in. I mean, so far this season, Jennings just has one touchdown in 342 yards, and he's coming off of a game against BYU where he went 15 for 32 for 140. Again, didn't throw for a touchdown. Again, I haven't seen much of Kevin Jennings. I don't really know what to expect from Kevin Jennings. I think Sonny Dykes also said that too. He's not really sure exactly what to expect either, because I think SMU is a bit of an unknown entity right now. You're not really sure. You can't really say, hey, SMU is just going to go down easy, but also they might be in for a treat against a TCU team that maybe is at a bit of a low spot right now. And also, you've got to watch out for Colin Rogers, their kicker. This guy had five field goals this weekend. Poor guy had to do all the scoring for SMU. So watch out for him. If they're in field goal range, he hit, I think, two 50 or more yard field goals, a 53-yard field goal, and I want to say maybe a 58-yard field goal too. No, 52 and 53. But watch out for him. He's got a bit of a leg, so at least we know SMU can kick it if they can't score. But I just want to see TCU just elevate their game kind of in all facets. And also, I want to see a full 60-minute game. I feel like we also haven't really gotten that. Obviously, we had it against LIU. But against teams like Stanford, against a team like UCF, you want to see 60 minutes of good football the whole way through, and we just really haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, and that's a great point. I just wanted to touch on a couple of things you mentioned there, and one of those is that I completely agree with, you know, Cam Cook just hopefully, you know, trying to find his rhythm here, and one thing that I think might help that is that SMU is allowing 141 rushing yards per game, which places them kind of in the middle of the pack when it comes to all of college football, but on the flip side of that, TCU is averaging only 81 rushing yards per game. So it's kind of a contrast in styles there. This open SMU defense to the run game might allow TCU's offense to finally get that rhythm on the ground. And then another thing that you noticed, you mentioned about the TCU defense. One thing that I wanted to note is that they rank 114th in the country in opponent third down conversion rate. So that's pretty horrendous. And it kind of, you know, characterizes all the struggles we've been talking about on defense where, you know, you see a lot of, you know, high effort, high energy plays that, you know, show the potential that this defense can have. But I think when it really comes to getting off the field and stopping opponents on third down, that is where they struggle. They're allowing a 52% conversion rate, which is actually right behind Vanderbilt and Florida State. So not two football teams that you necessarily want to be in the same breath as when it comes to defense.
Yeah, it's I mean, we'll talk about FSU later, but yeah, I mean, defensively there's definitely spots to tighten up, right? I mean, this is a very different defense than we've seen over the last 2 years too, but there's still parts, especially in this very young season, that I think we all want to see a little bit more from, whether that's pressure, whether that's more mindfulness of not bringing too much pressure, maybe some more discipline from your DBs and things like that. But again, I'm confident in TCU going into this weekend. I don't think this will be nearly as tough of a game as UCF, but also TCU needs to make sure that they don't play down to anybody's level. They need to keep their standard, play their game. Just like you said, Luke, you can't fall into a trap of playing into what the team, what your opponent wants you to do. And hopefully against a team like SMU, this provides an opportunity for TCU to kind of flex their muscles, do what they want, and have some control over the game.
I think the interesting thing, though, that we're forgetting about is it's the Iron Skillet game. So there's always some craziness that goes on in this matchup. TCU leads the overall or all-time series 49-41 with seven ties. Crazy that there's ties.
Seven ties, man.
TCU has a win streak of two going into this game. Last year, it was like the biggest blowout, or not the furthest apart game that we've seen in a little while. I mean, dating before last year, TCU won by one possession 42-34, and then they lost 34-42. They lost again 38-41, and then it was 2018 was the last time the Frogs really blew out the Mustangs 42-12. So I mean, going on the road, it's going to be a hostile environment. I mean, SMU, I feel like, hates us more than we hate them at this point. And it's going to be interesting to see how the TCU fans go and arrive at that game. It's going to be very interesting to see, you know, how Josh Hoover plays on the road. I mean, we saw him last time on the road against Stanford, and he played pretty well. But going back to your point, just to end it off, just I'd like to see a complete game from TCU. I mean, against Stanford, they started off slow, and at halftime of that game, they were trailing 17-13. And then they were able to outscore the Cardinals 24-10. Mm-hmm. So that's a great way to end a game. But then against the Golden Knights last week, they started great in the first half and then faltered in the second half. And so I think this is a great opportunity for the Frogs to kind of get it put together and make this a well together put or a full game of TCU football. So I can't wait. Well, we just finished our preview of the SMU TCU game this Saturday in Dallas. We're going to talk some more college football.
Predictions, man.
Oh, I forgot about the predictions, man. I forgot about the predictions. All right, we'll start with you, Luke. What is your prediction for this week's matchup?
To your point about the Iron Skillet being a little bit more of that rival. Well, it's a rivalry game for both teams, of course, but a little bit more at stake for SMU, I think, here, especially already losing to a Big 12 team. And they coming off that bye week. You know, there's a common saying in football, though, if you have two quarterbacks, you have none. And, you know, after Preston Stone, you know, attempted four passes and, you know, only got sacked three times and they took him out. Kevin Jennings came in. Accuracy was a little spotty. He's a running quarterback. You know, we saw with Ashton Daniels with Stanford a little bit, you know, of lapses in the defense, stopping the quarterback, containing the quarterback. Saw it a little bit better against KJ Jefferson and UCF. I think this TCU defense knows how to execute against a running quarterback, and with Kevin Jennings starting, I think that's going to be just enough to give the Frogs a 38-31 victory over the Mustangs.
Wow.
Very close game.
38-31. Okay.
Ian, we'll go with your prediction.
I'm kind of along the same lines there with Luke. I don't think this TCU offense is going to have much trouble. I'm curious to see how the defense deals with Kevin Jennings and the rest of SMU, just again, because they are a bit of an unknown at this point. I'm going to say 41-27 TCU.
41-27. Interesting. I'm going to go along the lines of a 34-24 win for the Frogs. I think SMU will get a late touchdown, so it'll feel like a bigger blowout than a 10-point final score. But I think the Frogs' offense is going to travel, and I think the TCU defense is going to have a bounce-back performance in terms of against the run. I'm excited to see how SMU's quarterback room performs. If it is Who am I forgetting? Kevin Jennings. It'll be interesting to see how he performs. They're coming off a bye week, the Mustangs are, so that's also something into play. How does that really impact college football? I know it's big in the pros in terms of coming off the bye. In terms of college, it'll be very interesting, especially home game. The fans are, you know, in a they're waiting. They haven't had a game last week. Now they're going to have 2 full weeks to prepare for the next one. So I'm expecting TCU to answer the call on the road and win against the Mustangs. Well, that'll do it for, finally, I can end this segment, against our recap or our prediction segment for SMU TCU this weekend. I'm excited. It's on the CW for the first time for the Frogs, which is interesting at 4 o'clock, is CW 4 o'clock. We are timing on everything, but it'll be very interesting to see how they covered the game.
Classic ACC.
I can't wait. Well, you're listening to Riff Ram Review here on KTCU, the choice, your choice for college radio. We'll continue Riff Ram with more college football as we take a look nationwide. Stay tuned, because we'll be right back after this short break.
Welcome back to Riff Ram Review right here on 88.7 The Choice, your choice for college radio. Ian Apician joined alongside Luke Anderson and Jackson James as we continue on with some college football talk. We talked about TCU-UCF. We talked about TCU-SMU and the preview for that. But now it's time to go through the week two games of college football. Well, sorry, week two or week three are we?
I think it's week three.
Week three. Okay. I was living under a rock for about a week. But week three. CFB roundup here. We're going to talk about some Big 12 games, mainly just a couple Big 12 teams, but there's obviously some other games nationwide that we want to get to. We're going to start off with Kansas losing to UNLV this weekend. Kansas, my goodness, they just don't look like the team that I think everybody expected them to be. Jalen Daniels really putting up a bit of a shocker this season. What are you guys' thoughts early on? Because Kansas is 1-2 right now.
Yeah, not to pat ourselves on the back, but I think last week we did mention that Kansas and Jalen Daniels were a bit overrated, because it seems like the past couple years, anytime Jason Bean has come into that game, you know, he had really kind of transformed that Kansas offense the past couple years. And so we saw signs of it, you know, as I mentioned in the past couple years, but we didn't really truly know if this new look Kansas team with all these playmakers around him and this fantastic defense and, you know, an extra year under Lance Leipold would really be the final year that Jalen Daniels makes that next step. But unfortunately for the Jayhawks, Jalen Daniels just doesn't look the part.
Yeah. And I would say this, what's the word, but the word that I'm looking for is encapsulates the game is at half. UNLV was driving, and this was what I touched on earlier, I think, when we were recapping TCU-UCF in terms of clock management. And the Rebels were driving, and they, for some reason, were just staying on the field, not calling any timeouts, not spiking the ball or whatever. And so then they're like in field goal range, but they're still deciding to go for it. And they wait till the last possible second, I think 3 seconds left as I'm trying to get the play sequence. And they somehow throw the ball over the top of a Kansas State Kansas defender, and they're able to score with no time left on the clock in the first half. And that kind of just shows how, you know, underwhelming this Kansas team is. I feel like last year and the year before, they wouldn't make mistakes like this. And this really teetered the game as it ended up being a 3-point game at the final score. And so to have moments like that, it almost feels like it's a turnover or like a pick six, something like that, just because of how, you know, you're entering the locker room with all the momentum that just dissipated.
Yeah, this Kansas team is definitely different, and I do think it's funny because actually these two teams faced off last year in December for the Guaranteed Rate Bowl, I think that's what it was called. Kansas actually ended up winning that one 49-36, but you know, just about a year later, you've got both of these teams in very different spots. And UNLV starting the season off 3-0. They've beaten two Big 12 teams, Houston to start off the year, then they beat Utah Tech, but then Kansas being the next Big 12 team. Just very interesting. Again, not really sure what's going on with Jalen Daniels. Obviously, it's not how Kansas is expecting things to go. Now they're 1-2. But Kansas lost to UNLV. The next kind of Big 12 team we want to talk about briefly is Arizona State. They took the game to the Texas State Bobcats. They went 3-0. Arizona State is now 3-0 after winning 31-28.
Give them their flowers.
Yeah, Sam Levitt, 19 for 30, 246 yards and a touchdown. And then Jordan McCloud for Texas State had 268 yards and four touchdowns. I didn't watch this game, but I think for Arizona State to start off 3-0, they're in a new conference now. Obviously, they haven't played any Big 12 games yet, but it's a very good start to a bit of a new era for the Big 12 for Arizona State.
Yeah, in a game where Cam Scataboo, one of the nation's leading running backs, just wasn't able to get going at all, 24 carries for 62 yards. He did get two touchdowns, so that's still a very, you know, clear emphasis in their offense. This is a game where you saw Arizona State defense kind of come alive, especially against a highly touted transfer in Jordan McCloud coming over from James Madison. He had a solid game, but the decision making clearly seems to not be fully there. And these Arizona State linebackers, I think, were just making it incredibly hard for the Texas State Bobcats to run the ball pretty much all game. Jordan McCloud, of course, still having a good game with 268 yards and four touchdowns. He threw that one interception late that kind of sealed the deal. But I think that this just kind of more does a service for an Arizona State team that's starting 3-0 for the first time since Jalen Daniels was a true freshman in 2019.
Wow.
So not too long ago, but for a program like Arizona State, kind of interesting to not see them be 3-0 at all over the last 5 years. So
yeah, it's a great start for Arizona State. I did not know that they hadn't gone 3-0 since 2019, so that's definitely an interesting little nugget there. I guess now, changing gears a little bit, we've talked a little bit about Big 12 teams. A former Big 12 team, Texas, now leads the country after they jumped over and leapfrogged Georgia for the number one spot in the NCAA top 25 polls after their 56-7 win over UTSA. UTSA was coming off of a 49-10 loss to Texas State the week before. And it wasn't that this game was going to be anything tough for Texas, but I think, you know, everybody got to see a little bit more of Quinn Ewers. Obviously, he exited the game having to deal with, I think, what they called an abdominal strain. So Quinn Ewers most likely going to be out for this next game against Louisiana Monroe. But Arch Manning stepped in. He did a fine job, more than fine job, 9 for 12 for 223 yards and four touchdowns. Not to mention, he had a huge rushing touchdown. Do you guys know how long that rushing touchdown was?
67 yards.
Yep. Dang.
Yeah. No, he had a great, I don't want to call it a debut because he has gotten some plays in before. But like, I guess I don't even want to call it a coming out party just because he has had plays for the Longhorns. But this was one of the moments where it's like, oh boy, like, is Ewers going to be out for a while? Yeah. Are we going to officially see, you know, Arch Manning have some plays? And to only throw more touchdowns than incompletions is just insane. He completed 75% of his passes for 223 yards. Technically, his stats were better than Quinn Ewers, but, yeah, you know, in terms of where Texas goes for the rest of the season, I don't think it's really up for debate. I think they're going to stick with Cam Ewers, unless Arch Manning just goes full Heisman mode and just leads this team. I don't think Texas's schedule, I mean, next week, like you said, Louisiana Monroe, and then as I'm trying to find it, then they start getting into SEC play with Mississippi State, and then the Red River rivalry with Oklahoma, and then they play Georgia. So probably Quinn Ewers will hopefully get back, if you're a Longhorns fan, by the Oklahoma game, which I have seen weird things on his injury report on how much time he's going to miss. I've seen somewhere it's like, oh, he's not going to miss any, and then I've seen somewhere it's like he's going to at least miss one game. So I don't think the Longhorns are going to be like vulnerable without him. I think Arch Manning's clearly one of the best backups in the nation, if you even want to call him a backup. So, but the Longhorns, they are ramping up. They look good before they enter SEC play.
Yeah, two things on that. One, the speed from Arch Manning, we're not used to seeing that type of speed with any of the Manning brothers, whether it's Eli or Peyton. So that was very interesting to watch. But kind of to your point about Quinn Ewers, right? He's had to deal with abdominal strains and abdominal injuries in the past. Not saying that this is going to be some new injury that's just going to pop up and now it's going to come and linger, but it's becoming a trend now. It wasn't, you know, the first time, maybe it's a one-off. The second time, okay, maybe you just did something to re-injure it. Third time, fourth time that you're kind of seeing the same thing, I'm curious to see how he deals with it or if it becomes something that lingers. And again, as a quarterback, I mean, I'm not a scientist, but you need to have good core strength. You have to have, you're going to be stressing those abdominal muscles quite a bit as a quarterback. So I'm curious to see how quickly he can get over it, but still maintain his health to still play at a high level.
And that is just one quick note that I wanted to mention too. You mentioned it perfectly that the abdominal strains on quarterbacks tend to wear a lot, you know, harder on these quarterbacks, especially quarterbacks that like to sling the ball. He's also, a big body quarterback that stands in the pocket, and he's going to absorb a lot of hits. A lot of his, you know, elite decision making comes from sticking his ground in that pocket, climbing the pocket, and then surveying and taking a large hit, but still stepping up and delivering that throw. So, you know, you need that abdomen to really get that torque and fire off those deep throws that have made him, you know, a potential top 10 pick in this upcoming draft. So either way, I think that Texas is okay. But, you know, with that Georgia game looming in about 3 weeks here, you definitely want the senior quarterback back.
Yeah, so Texas, though, obviously still winning 56-7 over UTSA. They jumped to the number one spot as number two Georgia now. They're coming off of what was a very interesting game against the University of Kentucky. They squeaked out with a 13-12 win. Obviously, I didn't watch any of it. I doubt either of you guys watched it because it was during the same time as the TCU game. But as I think Jackson and I were leaving, we saw the TVs were like, wow, okay, this game is actually super close. And obviously hoping that Kentucky could somehow pull this one out. But really close game for Georgia. Again, I didn't watch this game. I wasn't sure what happened, but crazy to think that Georgia could have lost this one.
Yeah, I mean, we were keeping track of the score during the game, and Kentucky was up 3-0, like, with 11 minutes left in the second quarter. And we're like, what in the world's going on? And then as I look at the comparison stats, Kentucky got 11 more first downs than the Bulldogs. They had 20 more total yards offensively. Rushing, they had 70 more yards rushing. And then you see uncharacteristic things from Georgia. They had 9 penalties for 85 yards. The Wildcats only had 4 for 23. So you look at this score, and it looks like everything was cooking for the Wildcats in this one, but Georgia still able to pull out the victory. I mean, we were talking about this on Frogs Up, our Saturday morning sports show, for a little bit, and we weren't necessarily paying too much attention because it's Georgia. I mean, going against Kentucky, I mean, Georgia is clearly the better team. But, I mean, this goes to prove how, like, tough this SEC is going to truly be, especially when you play on the road. This was almost going to be one of the first, you know, storming the field that we've seen this season. That would have been one of the best upsets for sure this season. So it's definitely interesting to see how Georgia, you know, kind of puts themselves together. I want to look at their schedule here in the next couple of weeks. They are at Bama this week. So
Georgia's
at Bama, so they definitely got to clean it up this weekend before they go and play the Crimson Tide.
And one note on that, I think my biggest takeaway from this game was just the fact that Georgia kind of needs to find out that second wide receiver behind Dominic Lovett. And it really just doesn't seem like they have the playmakers that they have in the past couple of years. Now, again, 3 games in, we're still early, so it seems like they could still be just shaking off some rust. But, you know, Carson Beck didn't necessarily do anything phenomenal. 15 for 24, 160 yards, no touchdowns, no picks. But as I mentioned, Dominic Lovett, 6 receptions for 89 yards. And then you didn't really get much out of that receiving core, the next closest receiver having 2 receptions. And so you'd like to see the Dylan Bells, the Arian Smiths of the world, even Trevor Etienne out of the backfield, you know, get a few more touches. It just seems like they were kind of sleepwalking through that game and maybe underestimated Kentucky coming off that loss from South Carolina. Because remember, this is a Kentucky defense that gave up a boatload of points to South Carolina the week before and really locked it down against this Georgia receiving core.
Yeah, they play Bama in 2 weeks. So they don't play this Saturday, they play the following Saturday. But then you maybe think, is this a potential trap game? Was this a trap game for the Bulldogs, even though they had a bye week after this? I think there's some of that in play potentially because, you know, they always have, you know, big important games against Bama, especially on the road. So I thought that's an interesting knock. But yes, they have 1 week to prepare before they go on the road and play Bama in Tuscaloosa.
Yeah, that one should be interesting. A game that actually ended up being really interesting this weekend was the one that ESPN Game Day was at, and that was LSU at South Carolina. I don't know if you guys had a chance to watch or tune into that game, but that one was back and forth for the longest time until LSU scored a touchdown with just over a minute left. There's a 2-yard run by Josh Williams to kind of cap things off against the Gamecocks. But, man, I mean, this game kind of came out of nowhere, to be honest, for me, with how LSU has started the season. I mean, again, LSU hasn't been fantastic either, but it was a much closer game than I expected it to be. Unfortunately, I was really hoping that South Carolina could pull it out to try to tie the game. I think it was a 49-yard field goal attempt from Herrera, and he just missed it wide left, I want to say. But this was a really, this is to me probably the best game of the weekend. I think the most exciting one. Kind of, you know, if we were to look back, this weekend wasn't filled with a bunch of crazy fun back and forth games, but for ESPN Game Day to be at this one, the first time it had been in South Carolina for over 10 years, they sure picked a good one. So
yeah, sort of a breakout game for Rocket Sanders, 19 carries, 143 yards and two touchdowns. It's kind of what South Carolina has been doing all year, which is just, we're going to run the ball and you're going to have to stop it. And then that's going to open up some, our chances to take those deep shots, you know, down the sideline. And we're going to break open a couple big plays that way each week as well. Again, obviously the main talking point of this game is that, that interception return touchdown called back, late in the fourth quarter there that took 7 points off the board for South Carolina. Now it's come to my attention that the SEC has already sent a letter to Shane Beamer, and they've already apologized for the missed call there. That doesn't really matter to South Carolina fans, unfortunately, because that is one loss on the ticker there for them. So I think that this game was phenomenal. I think it was, you know, a great choice for game day. But I think that LSU is still experiencing some hiccups on offense. I think that they have the makings to be, you know, that elite LSU offense of the past couple of years. I still believe in Garrett Nussmeier. I know he had that one interception, you know, on a bad, and really should have been two interceptions there. But then that first interception was, you know, a tough decision. But I just think that LSU still has, you know, the makings of a high-powered offense. It's just that defense that's a little bit behind.
Well, that'll kind of wrap us up here for the college football segment. We didn't want to go through too many games, but just wanted to highlight some of the ones that were kind of interesting to us. Obviously, we're talking about Texas with the Ewers and Arch Manning situation. Georgia falling now to number two, like that really matters much. But yeah, it was an interesting weekend of college football. Again, nothing crazy, nothing to write home about, but kind of nice to end it with talking a little bit about that LSU South Carolina game. That was definitely something different than I think most people expected. So that'll wrap up our college football talk for tonight's show. But stick right here. We're going to get into NFL for about the next 30 to 40 minutes, starting off with talking about the Panthers, the biggest news, Bryce Young over to the bench, Andy Dalton starting this weekend against the Las Vegas Raiders. So stick right here. You're listening to Riff Ram Review on 88.7 The Choice.
Welcome back to Riff Ram Review here on 88.7 KTCU The Choice. We've talked a little bit about college football. Now we're going to move on to NFL Week 2. And the big news here in Week 2, Horned Frog legend Andy Dalton
getting
the start against the Oakland.
I love this guy.
The Las Vegas Raiders.
I love it.
Sorry to
Please,
tug
Oakland.
At the heartstrings there. benching Bryce Young are the Panthers. We'll start with you, Ian. Kind of some general reactions. Andy Dalton facing your favorite team this week.
Yep.
What do we kind of expect? What are your reactions to the Panthers moving on, but kind of not giving their second year quarterback as much run as, you know, people thought?
Yeah, no, it's an interesting decision. I know you and I talked about this at length actually in class today. So we'll dive into it more. But first reaction, I'm always much more of a sympathizer for these young quarterbacks. You know, these guys get picked first, second, third overall. They get tossed into the worst teams that have no offensive line, that have no sort of targets or talent around them, and they're expected to go in there from the ownership and the fans. They're expected to go in there and lead this team to some sort of what would be considered a quote-unquote successful season. Bryce Young is 2-16 as a starter. Awful. Absolutely awful. He's a shorter quarterback, 5'10". He hasn't been playing very well this season at all. But at the same time, the dude's got nothing to throw to, you know? And so initially, I kind of sympathize with Bryce Young. I still sympathize with him in saying, look, you know, unfortunately, this is just how quarterbacking is now, especially with rookie quarterbacks. Great opportunity, though, for Andy Dalton. I am kind of dealing with a little PTSD because 2 years ago when the Rams picked up Baker Mayfield to play the Raiders the next week, and he ended up beating us on a game-winning fourth-quarter drive, that sucked as a Raiders fan. So expectations for this weekend is you better win. I'm fearful we're going to end up losing to the Red Rifle, but, you know, hands up here. Hey, he's a TCU legend.
I'm excited for the Red Rifle to return. But no, the Carolina Panthers have failed Bryce Young, and it goes way beyond just the receiving core and their skill positions on the offensive side. We saw this preseason, C.J. Stroud played two games coming off his rookie year. We saw Derek Carr, a veteran in this league that's played, I don't even know how many seasons, at least 10 plus, it feels
like. This is
like
his 11th season.
Yeah, 11th season. He played two games because he has a new offense. Carolina brought in a new head coach, an offensive-minded guy. And Bryce Young did not play at all in the preseason. And then you throw him into these first couple games. And we see veterans all the time not play preseason, so it's not crazy. But when you had a guy that struggled his rookie year, and then you bring in a new guy, and you don't play him at all in the preseason, you're asking to get results like this. In his last game against the Chargers, he had 84 yards for an average of 3.2 yards per completion. And just absolutely brutal. He was sacked twice, had one interception, and just the Panthers never really stood a chance, and they really don't stand a chance in really any of the games they play. So is Andy Dalton necessarily the way to go, you know, for it to win the culture? Probably, just because he's a veteran. He may be used to this off. He may be more able to adapt to this offensive scheme because he's been on so many different teams. So it's kind of his advantage. I'm excited. Maybe I'll actually watch a Panthers game this season just because I love Andy Dalton. Follow Andy Dalton News on Twitter. That's all I'll say on that.
Oh, it, touching on a point that you made, Ian, I think that, you know, with a guy like Bryce Young, Tom Brady really mentioned it when he talked about the way that the NFL is going with these young quarterbacks is that in the way that contracts and teams are structured is that these young quarterbacks, they don't have time to sit and develop and learn. They have to play right away. A lot of times, like, teams are built, and a lot of these recent Super Bowl champions have been built with a quarterback on a small rookie contract. So you have to perform in those first 4 to 5 years. And because we have to be able to spend money on the weapons and the team around you. So I think that just places a whole lot more pressure on these young quarterbacks. And then for a guy like Bryce Young, who is already about 5'10", 5'11", a small guy. So he's not just short. He's a little bit smaller, too. Not the same kind of frame that you'd love for a prototypical NFL quarterback to have in order to withstand those hits and to just be able to stand up for 17 games a season, you know. A point that Ian and I talked about earlier today is that I wonder if this is a way for the Panthers to see where the problems reside and where those problems are coming from, where that source is. So I think that maybe the idea is that we get Andy Dalton in here and we say, hey, this is a veteran guy who's played 10 plus years in the NFL. He knows how to run an offense. He's seen pretty much every look that the NFL can throw at him. Let's see if he can execute with our offense. And if he can, then maybe it is a Bryce Young problem. Maybe Bryce Young isn't developing quick enough. But if Andy can't, you know, if Dalton comes in and he's, you know, not moving the ball. The Panthers have scored 13 points over their first two games. If they have a similar offensive performance under Andy Dalton, it doesn't seem like anything is changing. Then maybe, you know, you take a step back and you say, hey, this is the front office. This is the leadership. This is the coaching in place. We cannot succeed with this staff. So I wonder if they're just giving Andy Dalton a little bit of run here to see if that those problems are on Bryce Young or if they're a larger, you know, example or you know, that reason is coming from the coaching staff and the rest of the team.
I think one fear that Panthers fans have is what if Andy Dalton does well? Because then it's like, oh, then there's really only one person you kind of can point the finger to,
right?
Which is obviously horrible because not only did the Panthers draft him first overall, but then they traded with the Bears, gave away DJ Moore, one of the better weapons in the NFL. They gave away a first round. I don't know how many first round picks, maybe one to three of them.
They essentially built a team for the Bears, yep, that they should have built for Bryce Young.
And so now you have him, or you have a team that is at least decent if Andy Dalton balls out or like exceeds expectations. But then if Andy Dalton doesn't, then you're like, okay, now let's hopefully build from scratch. I would probably even stick with Andy Dalton even if he were to play bad, just because you don't want to throw Bryce Young out there, continue to have bad expectations. That's kind of what happened with Zach Wilson. They put him out on a bad offense, or at least a lackluster offensive scheme, and then they had to keep throwing him out because they really didn't have anyone as a backup. The minute Now, Zach Wilson's obviously a much different story because they put in Mike White and Mike White balls out. But if Andy Dalton does the same, then it's like, oh, crap. Then you got to start looking at other options. But I still think regardless, even if Bryce Young was the answer, this team is very far away before becoming a true contender.
Yeah, and kind of to that point, right, I think you said it right there perfectly. You alluded to the Jets issue, right, with Mike White and Zach Wilson. And at what point do you as a head coach say, you know what, I can't be messing up with my quarterback's heads? I mean, it's not going to mess up with Andy Dalton's head. He's a 10-year veteran. You're going to mess up with Bryce Young's head. And I guarantee you his head's already messed up because he was told he's still starting against the Raiders, and less than 24 hours after that was said, he gets benched, right? And so I think that's the danger you risk. It's not necessarily, you know, and I'm not going to go talk into and make this like a mental health type conversation about quarterbacks, but confidence is huge in young quarterbacks. Bryce Young is 2-16. I don't know what Panther fans expected, but you can't put a, you know, it's like having the nicest house on the worst street. You can't expect the neighborhood then to start looking nice just because you have the nicest house. It's still going to be a bad neighborhood. And you know, that might not be the most perfect like explanation for it, but Bryce Young is a piece to what this team needs to be. Yeah, you have Adam Thielen, who is an aging wide receiver. If he's your only target, that makes it easy for defenses to cover. You have Hayden Hurst as your tight end. Goodness gracious, you have an awful defense. And also not to mention, this isn't to give the Panthers the benefit of the doubt too, but they also played the Saints week one and the Chargers week two, which we'll talk about very soon. But both of those teams are 2-0. Both of those teams also might legitimately be some of the best teams in the NFL with some of the best defenses. The Chargers have given up 13 points. Panthers have only scored 13 points. I don't know which one's more impressive. They're impressive in completely bipolar respects. But this Panthers team, again, no matter what, they've got a big issue. And again, Adam Thielen said it today in an interview. He said this isn't a Bryce Young issue. He says this is a team offensive issue. And if that's him trying to be a bit of a veteran and take that focus off of Bryce Young as a second-year quarterback, and more put it on the team and talk about the decision making and maybe, hey, is this offense, who's leading this offense, right? I mean, that's a whole nother story, but there's so many issues with the Panthers, and they have failed him completely by not building around him. And now you see Caleb Williams go into a team that was really nicely built in part thanks to the Panthers, but Caleb Williams is having trouble too. He's a rookie quarterback that's still trying to find his way. So this is a trend. This has been going on for quite a while. I think it's just tough now that once Bryce Young was benched, once that news broke, you're just like, man, that's tough. And, you know, who knows if he's going to be able to come back from that or not, depending on how Andy Dalton does.
I will say this before we end this segment. You look at Miami with Brian Flores and Tua's relationship. That was turmoil, was not healthy for Tua. They take out Brian Flores, put in a supportive coach in Mike McDaniels. Tua then blossoms. You look at a situation right now in Tennessee with Dave Canales and Will Levis. That's seeming like a toxic relationship, or at least the head coach doesn't like his quarterback, saying, what was the quote? We can't have it. He's got to protect our team better. He's got to protect the ball better. It's inexcusable to do those types of things. He's a grown-up. He knows better. And he's kind of talking down to his quarterback to the media, and so that's obviously creating certain issues. If the quarterback doesn't feel comfortable with the head coach, how does that translate to on the field? And then we see situations like this with Bryce Young and Dave Canales. If Canales wasn't the quarterback or wasn't the coach that, you know, the Panthers drafted Bryce Young, wasn't there when he wasn't in the draft room when they selected him, so he doesn't feel any attachment to Bryce Young, which I think isn't necessarily his fault, but it's also, you are the head coach of this team. You know this team, or you know this player is a keystone for the future of this team and the team right now. So you kind of have to build around him. And Bryce Young was shocked by the benching. And so that plays into more of the mental game of it all. And so I think, you know, the Panthers at large are just kind of failing Bryce Young. I'll leave it at that.
I think so too. And one last thing, 3 different offensive coordinators for Bryce Young across 18 games. So not a ton that you can put on the back of Young, but we'll be interested to see how Andy Dalton, the former TCU legend, fares against the Las Vegas Raiders this week. Ian, you alluded to it a little bit earlier. The Panthers have struggled, you know, they struggled against two 2-0 teams, the Saints and the Chargers, that we have some rather strong takes about. But we're going to run through kind of a contender or pretender segment here. You see a lot of times during the year, ESPN will do this contender or pretender list, you know, ranking the remaining undefeated teams. So there are currently I believe, 7 or 8. Yes. Nine. Hey, there we go, counting.
I was doing it too. I was like, wait, hold on. How many are there?
9 2-0 teams. Those teams in the NFC are the Seattle Seahawks, New Orleans Saints, Minnesota Vikings, and Tampa Bay Buccaneers. And those teams in the AFC are the Buffalo Bills, the Los Angeles Chargers, the Kansas City Chiefs, the Pittsburgh Steelers, and the Houston Texans. So I think we're just going to kind of start off with a rather simple question. Which of these teams do each of you guys believe in?
If I had to choose one for each, I would say for the NFC, I would say the Saints. I think the Saints are the team that are most built to go forward. I'd say it's the Saints, and then the Buccaneers are on the same level. I'm not really sure. I know how I feel about the Seahawks. I don't think that they're really contenders. The Vikings, I think, are doing well really early, but it depends if that's going to be sustainable throughout the season. But I'm going with the Saints. The Saints offense, I mean, I don't really have to explain much. I mean, they've been absolutely fantastic. They've gotten 93 points so far this season. They've outscored their opponents by, I think, 83 points or somewhere around that, like mid-70s to low 80s point range. Their offense has been wonderful under Derek Carr. Really happy to see him. If anybody knows, obviously me being a Raiders fan, I love Derek Carr. So I'm always rooting for him. But Saints have really surprised me so far this season. And then also for the AFC, I hate to say it because I'm a Raiders fan, but the Chargers are doing really well. It's less of their offense, but that defense is looking really solid as of late. I mean, just a couple numbers for you guys, and I mean, take it for what you will, but this defense so far has allowed 227 yards per game, which is second best in the NFL. That's behind Luke's Tennessee Titans. They have the sixth best passing and rushing defense, and they've also allowed a league low of 13 points. That's the Raiders and the Panthers combined. So nothing crazy. But still, this defense is fantastic, and we talked about it even last week, right? You see defenses for the Chargers. You go into any season, and you expect their defense to be locked and loaded. It just depends on if they stay healthy. But I really think this Chargers team is going to do well. And then offensively, to be honest, Justin Herbert hasn't done much. He hasn't had to do much because it's J.K. Dobbins that's been providing a lot. They've got the second best rushing game in the NFL. They average 197 yards per game rushing. Dobbins has 266 of the Chargers' 395 rushing yards. He's been a fantastic addition, as has Gus Edwards. That tailback tandem from Baltimore is doing things really nicely in LA. But I really feel like the Chargers and the Saints, for me, are the two kind of front runners. And I know we'll talk a little bit more about that, but just kind of starting us off there. So,
yeah, I'm just going to touch on the Chargers just because we mentioned them there, because they're my team from the AFC as well. That I believe in as a contender among these 2-0 teams. I think one thing that I kind of wanted to note is that I think in a league that's kind of trending toward this air raid, pass-heavy attack, and you see a Los Angeles Chargers team in the past few years under Brandon Staley that kind of, you know, focused on that as well. They had a pass-catching back in Austin Ekeler out of the backfield that they kind of utilized a whole lot more in the receiving game rather than establishing the run up the middle. This year, completely different under Jim Harbaugh. He says, we're going to run that football, and we're going to line up in three tight end sets. We're gonna go against the grain when the whole league is shifting toward airing the ball out. We're gonna ground and pound, and that's gonna open up some of those shots. So we're gonna pick and choose when we take those shots. But for the majority of the game, we're gonna pound it down your throat as much as we can. And I just think that kind of physical style of football is something that the NFL has you know, gotten away from a little bit. You see with the Titans firing Mike Vrabel, you know, them moving toward, you know, a pass heavy attack, and just the way that the league is trending. A lot of coordinators are hired as head coaches because they were passing game coordinators and because they were revolutionizing the passing game in the NFL. So I just think it's really interesting to see a team kind of execute with this hard nosed style. Now, albeit it's only 2 weeks in, but I just think this fits this you know, style that the NFL is, you know, trending away from. I think to kind of counteract that is kind of a, you know, a revolutionary mindset.
I think you guys are both boneheaded for your decision on the AFC. I think the Chiefs are clearly the better team in this division.
I hate this.
Not a fan of that.
Well, see, the Chiefs are the easy pick.
Well, that's I'm not going to talk about them, but no, I mean, you look at a game like the against the Bengals,
or
a game
they?
That they did, clearly did not play their best ball against. They were still able to pull out the win, even though there were some hijinks with the penalty calls at the end of that game and whatnot. The game, the team I want to touch on really quick is the Buccaneers. I think they're going to be one of the true contenders in the NFC. They went on the road to their final game last season in the postseason in that divisional round, and they ended up beating the Detroit Lions in really, you know, surprising fashion how they were able to win this game. They won 20-16. They limited Jared Goff, or they held Jared Goff to 300 yards passing, but still two interceptions by that Bucs defense. They really clamped down. The Lions had their chances offensively late in the game to kind of, you know, overcome that lead, score a touchdown, and take the game away. Baker Mayfield didn't have a star-dazzling game. He only had 185 yards passing, a touchdown, interception. They didn't really have a great rushing game. Chris Godwin was their leading receiver with 117 yards, but then everyone after that had less than 50. So it wasn't necessarily too star-dazzling of a game, as I'm using these adjectives, for the Bucs, but it was still very impressive. Two games into the season, getting a statement win, maybe one of the better wins this season, especially going on the road to Ford Field, if I that's correct, for the Lions. Yep. And really, because that was that stadium vibe was electric. Lion fans are now really engaged. They came off a great win against the Rams week one. Obviously, the Rams are dealing with their own injuries and stuff like that. But to be able to come on the road, because they were impressive week one in their game. And so for them to back it up as they defeated the Commanders week one, 37-20, Baker Mayfield's an early in the running for the early season MVP. I know it's kind of crazy. Derek Carr is probably leading that with how electric that Saints offense has been, scoring on every drive in the first three quarters for through the first two games. But this Bucs team is definitely a team to watch. I don't think they have two. I mean, if the Saints continue their dominance offensively, it's going to be very tough. But if you look at their division as a whole, the Falcons look shaky, and the Panthers are the Panthers. So it's going to be, you know, not an easy road, but a fairly easy road for the Buccaneers as they continue the season.
Yeah, it's funny. First of all, I'll say this is surprisingly been a very heavy NFC South talk tonight for the NFL, which is crazy. I mean, that wasn't on my bingo card division coming into tonight, but exactly. And to that point, I don't think anyone expected the NFC South to be nearly as good as it has been, even to just start the season, right? Sometimes you see this, and who knows, maybe this can kind of flutter out. Maybe this is just a bit of a just a bit of a flash in the pan. Who knows? But again, the Buccaneers look solid. It's not like they've just been playing wish-wash teams. They got two very quality wins. You know, this one against the Lions was huge. And again, now you look at the Saints, and I'll mention this because I didn't say it before, but I think a lot of Saints fans, or just fans maybe actually – fans that aren't fans of the Saints will maybe say, look, this team hasn't changed since last season in terms of player-wise. But the biggest addition that they got is a new offensive coordinator in Clint Kubiak, who is Gary Kubiak's son. Gary Kubiak used to coach, I want to say, for the Texans a little bit.
Yep.
But Clint Kubiak, I saw today, he's their offensive coordinator for the Saints. I was like, okay, where was he before? Where do you think he's from? He's the passing coordinator from the San Francisco 49ers. So not to say that it's a puzzle piece match made in heaven where you just stick it in there and all of a sudden Derek Carr is this new quarterback and this offense is completely new. But I was reading about it, and it was interesting to hear that Clint Kubiak doesn't want Derek Carr to be making so many decisions at the line. He's like, if you need to make an audible, or if I need you, if we want you to go quicker or slow the tempo down, we will tell you. We just focus on playing the game. And Derek Carr said it in the press conference he just had this weekend. He said, look, that takes a lot of pressure off of him to, obviously he's still going to try to read the defenses, make audibles when he has to, but to know that, hey, I've got a coordinator and a staff full of coaches that are also going to handle the brunt force of some of the decision making, and you know, for him it takes off the pressure and just allows him to go out there and just play. And I think he's been able to do that really nicely. And so obviously it's not just Clint Kubiak, but I think that was a very under the radar addition. I mean, I didn't even know this until today, until I was doing the research for the show, that they added him. But I mean, kudos to the Saints. Things have worked out really well. But to the main point that we're talking about here, the NFC South, it's a tale of two two, like, you know, the top two teams are great. The bottom two teams are horrible.
Well, I wouldn't say about the Falcons being horrible. I had them winning the division. I still think they are capable of doing
really?
That. It's really shaky.
Ooh, I don't know
on how that's going to play out. But I will say the Saints defense has been tremendous also. They've always been good under Dennis Allen, their head coach. So
that guy, former Raider head coach. I don't know how he still has a job, but fine.
Yeah, well, that will do it for our talk about the contender or pretenders among the 2-0 teams in the NFL. We've still got some more NFL to touch on, a little bit of an injury bug going around with some of the contending teams in the NFL here. Stick with us. This is Riff Ram Review on 88.7 KTCU The Choice.
You're listening to Riff Ram Review here on KTCU, the choice, your choice for college radio. I'm Jackson James, joined alongside Luke Anderson and Ian Napetian. We just got done talking a little pretender contender talk in NFL ball. National Football League. That's what I was going to say.
It's getting late on this Tuesday night.
we're 2 weeks in. I'm done. I'm so tired. But no, now we're going to talk a little injury bug, which is very interesting because it's shaping not only fantasy football, but the league as a whole. And it's only been 2 weeks, and there's been some, not necessarily a lot of season-ending injuries, but a lot of IR-induced. I was about to say IL for baseball, but no, IR for some pro teams we saw on Thursday. We'll start with that one first. I know we have this one last on our run sheet, but we're going to start with the first Tua's injury and how that impacts the Dolphins going forward. They fell to the Bills on Thursday Night Football 31-10. We'll start with Luke. What are your thoughts on Miami's current stance at the quarterback position?
Yeah, unfortunately, just a devastating injury for a guy that is just such a competitor and such a great guy that's really loved around the NFL. And so not only to see a guy go down in that manner, but in a manner that he's gone down in before is just really, really, you know, it kind of tugs at the heartstrings of football fans just because you've seen this guy battle back nearly every time he's faced adversity and really has gotten better each time he's battled back through those challenges. So I'm not sure how the Dolphins are going to go about this. There's always, you know, that former Miami Dolphin quarterback in free agency sitting there and Ryan Tannehill that they can go grab. Because personally, I think we've seen a little bit too much of the Skylar Thompson backup quarterback experiment. And not to judge him too harshly, but in order for the aspirations of the Dolphins to be met this year in terms of making the playoffs, which is at the bare minimum, I think what this Dolphins franchise is expecting with, you know, a talented offense like that and some weapons in the defense, I think that they have to go out and get another quarterback. And the market is kind of bleak, but I just don't think Skylar Thompson has really shown us that he's capable of leading this team to a playoff win.
Yeah, and again, I've talked about this thoroughly, whether it's this year or last year on the show, but, you know, the quarterback position, if you don't have two serviceable quarterbacks in going into an NFL season, you're really you're making it hard on yourself, because I don't think there's going to be a single NFL quarterback that plays every single snap of the season or will play every game of the season healthy. And I think for the Dolphins GM Chris Greer to be as naive as he was to start this season with Tua Tagovailoa and Skylar Thompson as your 1-2, it makes absolutely no sense. You're putting your team in a position to fail with a quarterback that has had way too many concussions, a history of concussions now. He's been the GM since 2016. He's been in this Tua. He's seen Tua from the start, and maybe he might even see the end of Tua, depending on what happens, right? But I just don't know how you can even enter a season with Skylar Thompson as your backup quarterback. I think that's concerning. I'm really curious to see how this goes with the Dolphins, where they decide to go again. You know, we've mentioned that there are a couple quarterbacks out there still looking for jobs, but again, it's a bit of a bleak market right now. You're 3 weeks into the season. Other teams have already picked up other guys as well. So the Dolphins, I mean, this is kind of the Dolphins' Achilles heel, and it hit them right at the worst time. Granted, they still have a really nice team built around them. They've still got Tyreek Hill, Jaylen Waddle, Devon Achane. I mean, guys that can still do some damage offensively, but it just seems all a bit too foolish to me to be entering a season with Tua as your pretty much your only punch at the quarterback position. But I'll just leave it there.
Skylar Thompson when he came in for the Bills was 8 of 14 worth 80 yards, no sacks or no touchdowns, no interceptions. So yeah, I mean, there's a ton of backup quarterbacks that the Dolphins will, I guess, eventually trade for. You've guys like Jameis Winston that's on the Browns. You have guys like, well, who am I blanking on? I mean, there's Trey Lance rumors with the Cowboys, yeah, potentially, even though that's obviously a riskier pick because Trey Lance hasn't yet to be proven himself.
Yeah, I'd mention one of those backup quarterbacks like you were alluding to there. I think, you know, you might start to look at a Trey Lance. As you mentioned, we saw the Packers make a move for Malik Willis, and that ended up paying off. I feel like these moves almost, as Ian mentioned, need to be made and accounted for in the offseason, because you really miss out on not only getting the best, you know, free agents, the best actual players, but you also miss out on integrating them to that offense during OTAs and helping them, you know, develop quarterbacks, because quarterbacks can develop other quarterbacks, and knowing that offense and having two guys that you trust wholeheartedly, like Ian said, to run that offense is just it changes the outlook of a team entirely, because you don't have to scramble and change your identity when you lose a quarterback that's so detrimental to your team.
The Miami Dolphins are at Seattle, then at home against the Titans and then at the Patriots. So not the hardest schedule going forward, but definitely not a cakewalk, especially on the defensive side of those teams. But as we transition, there were some other injuries that affected teams and the outcomes of their games on Sunday. Debo Samuel went down with a calf injury, and Christian McCaffrey is still out with an Achilles soreness, something along those lines, with a strain on his calf, and he was placed on IR, so he's out till at least week 4. And so it was very interesting to see how Minnesota Vikings were able to, it felt like they dominated the San Francisco 49ers. Jordan Mason, Christian McCaffrey's backup, had 20 carries for 100 yards on an average of 5, which is still really good and almost elite for a backup running back. Obviously, San Francisco 49ers have a great offensive line, so kind of goes in tandem with that. But Brock Purdy looked human without a full star-studded cast. Obviously, I think Debo Samuel's impact on the 49ers offense, as he had 8 receptions for 110 yards, led the team, truly hurts this team offensively. I want to hear your guys' thoughts on the current status of the San Francisco 49ers team.
Yeah, this is going to be an opportunity for Brock Purdy to prove the people wrong that say he's a game-managing quarterback. This is going to be his opportunity to go in and say, I can make do with a depleted offense. Granted, it's still one of the best offensive lines in the league. But again, I think Brock Purdy does his job as a quarterback. I don't look at Brock Purdy and say, my goodness, where was this guy? Why was he the last pick? Why was he Mr. Irrelevant? Yeah. Right. But again, there's something that he does that other guys can't do, and that's just be consistent and be serviceable. He's much better than being serviceable. But again, I think this is an opportunity for him career-wise, again, to prove those haters that say he's a good game manager as a quarterback, even though I still think he is. But this is going to have some big issues. Granted, you've seen that Jordan Mason has been able to provide a good enough running game. That's kudos to your offensive line as well as Jordan Mason too. But Debo Samuel being out, it's going to really drop this offense down from being nearly as multidimensional as it can be when everybody's healthy.
I think that's a great point, just in general, because if you had CMC out just on his own, you can replace that running attack with Jordan Mason. You still have Debo Samuel that you can throw in a lot of these exotic motions and all these different looks. You know, you can put him in the backfield. He runs the ball. He comes across on jet sweeps. You know, he's such a fundamental part of this football team on offense, and he's a lot of the reason that Kyle Shanahan has had so much success in his offenses, because of the way that he's able to mix and match and really put Debo anywhere on that line. I think that this is going to be, as you guys both have mentioned it, just a time for Brock Purdy to showcase who he is. Another person that I think, you know, can really showcase who he is Brandon Ayuk. I think it's his turn to pick up the slack, and you know, he signed that 4-year, $120 million contract, and you're looking at a guy that all offseason was talking about, hey, I'm the guy. I can go anywhere and I can be the guy. Well, Brandon, you are the guy now. and with McCaffrey out, I think that just weighs even more on both him and Brock Purdy. Obviously, Juwan Jennings is a fantastic a complimentary wide receiver. That's going to come down with pretty much any football you throw at him. But for a guy like Brandon Ayuk, who was talking all offseason about how much he means to an offense, I think it's a lot is going to be on his shoulders with a little bit less of that creativity that Kyle Shanahan can employ with McCaffrey out and with Debo out, you know, as his two favorite guys to run a lot of that creativity with. I think it's just going to be a lot more on Brandon Ayuk, because you also, you know, you fail or you know, you kind of forget sometimes that Ricky Pearsall is also working his way back from that shooting.
Crazy. Which is a
wild sentence right there.
From a bullet wound, man. Crazy.
So yeah, I'm really going to be keyed in on this offense.
I mean, that goes to the offseason with the Ricky Pearsall thing. You didn't think that was going to be a huge thing in terms of, you know, oh, the 49ers are deep enough at the wide receiver spot. Now you have a guy like Debo go down. Oh, we have a guy in Ricky Pearsall to step in, but now obviously he's on IR. So it's very interesting. They are at the LA Rams this Sunday. Then they're at home against the Patriots, then at home against the fierce Cardinals. The Cardinals are a very, I think, scary team this year. They're definitely proven the preseason haters wrong. So, I mean, speaking of the Rams, they have been hit with the injury bug. Cooper Kupp has an ankle injury. He may be going on the IR. Puka Nacua, his PCL and knee injury, he is on the IR. Then you have some O-line, some former Frogs go down with a couple injuries. Joe Noteboom, an ankle, and Steve Avila, a knee injury.
Yeah, this is really bad for the Rams. This is really bad. It's not one or the other. It's both. That like, you know, sorry. I have so much to say about this. I'm gonna say it really quick. The Rams have a quarterback in Matthew Stafford who is solely a pocket quarterback. Therefore, you need targets to get to get and find space quickly, and you need your offensive line there. They don't have any of that right now. They don't have a running game with Kyron Williams. They don't have an offensive line to provide a running game for Kyron Williams. You don't have targets now that Cooper Kupp and Puka Nacua are going to be out for some time. And then you've got Joe Noteboom and Steve Avila. Steve Avila last year was the only rookie in the league to play every single snap. He was severely underrated. And to protect a quarterback like Matthew Stafford, someone who is going to be a pocket quarterback 99% of the time, that takes a lot. So two former TCU guys here also that are hurt, unfortunately. But I think the Rams are in a really, really awful spot. It's not even like that they were doing well before this. Now that these injuries are really here, it's concerning.
I mean, you saw Matt Stafford against the Cardinals. That offense looked horrible. Yeah. I would say like they were unable to move the ball at all. Stafford only had 216 yards passing on 27 attempts, completed 19 of those. No touchdowns, no interceptions, was sacked 5 times. And so, yeah, you saw that in comparison. Kyler Murray was only sacked once. So, I mean, yeah, this is really bad for the Rams. I had their schedule pulled up. Let me take a quick look at their schedule. They're obviously playing the 49ers this week, and then they're at the Bears and then versus the Packers. So maybe Jordan Love returns for that one. So definitely not an easy schedule for the Rams.
One note on that schedule there, too, and I was going to mention it. I feel like going into this season, the Rams secondary was obviously, you know, in question quite a bit, but it was really kind of exposed against that Arizona Cardinals team, you know, that high-powered offense where they kind of threw the ball over the yard of them against them. And, you know, you saw the Marvin Harrison breakout game. I think that the Rams' lack of weapons on offense now, in addition to just their deteriorating offensive line, is just going to probably spoil the whatever hopes they had for this season, just because we knew coming into this year that they needed to score points and they needed to keep up with other teams. And Matthew Stafford isn't going to be able to get those quick hitters off because he doesn't have guys that can separate and you know, get off the line of scrimmage and get themselves open quick enough. So I think that this just kind of spells almost disaster for the Rams, and they might be trending toward a top five pick.
It'll be very interesting. I've seen some Matt Stafford mock trades. There's a very fine chance they go all the way through October without a win. And so at that point, you want to do a fire sale and just get rid of everybody as you can, get their value, especially because this was one of the best offenses in terms of skill weapons. Now, obviously, that's not the truth. There were some other injuries that kind of played a role. Justin Jefferson with his quad, Isaiah Pacheco with the Chiefs. He hurt his leg. He's now on IR. So there's definitely some moving pieces all around the NFL, and definitely make sure to keep track of your fantasy teams, because I know I am. I got to pay attention to that waiver wire. Well, anyways, that'll do it for our NFL injury bug segment here on Riff Rain Review. You're listening to KTC, The Choice, your choice for college radio.
Wow. welcome back to Riff Ram Review here on 88.7 KTCU The Choice. We've been talking a lot about football here today, Ian. Ian Napishan joined alongside Luke Anderson here. But we're going to transition to some baseball, finally. Switching up the sports. Now, quickly, I just kind of wanted to recap or I guess give kind of a summary of each of the wild card standings as we are wrapping up this final week and a half of the MLB regular season. Now, an AL wild card that wasn't particularly close for most of the season is actually trending toward being a race for that final spot. We have the Baltimore Orioles, who are currently situated in that first wild card pretty comfortably, and then right behind them with the Kansas City Royals in that second wild card spot. But that third wild card spot is currently up for grabs. The Minnesota Twins are sitting there at 80-71, but their AL Central foes, the Detroit Tigers, are looming right there at 78-73, just two games back of that final wild card spot. Now, Ian, I know that the A's are locked in a intriguing matchup with the White Sox this past weekend. So you might not have been able to watch any of the other games due to that prime time matchup there. But what are kind of your thoughts about the AL wild card and who you think it might take that last spot?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think overall it's been a very exciting season, whether you've looked at it from the offensive powerhouses of Judge, Shohei Ohtani, Bobby Witt Jr. coming out and doing a fantastic job this season. Guys like Tarek Skubal, pitching-wise for the Tigers, even looking at the NL2 with Chris Sale. It's been an exciting season overall, but it's been exciting because the AL Central has been so much more competitive than anyone ever thought it could be, right? You're seeing three teams in the AL Central literally fighting it out for pretty much the last two. So there's three teams for two spots, essentially. The Royals with a two-game lead, the Twins are in that last spot, and then the Tigers are two games out, right? So I at this point in the season, I can't really figure out who I think is going to take it. I think the Tigers have better overall pitching, and I would like to see Tarek Skubal be in the postseason, especially. But at the same time, I mean the Minnesota Twins have been there over the last year or two. They've had experience in this spot. Their team is primed and experienced to have to come down to the wire late in the season. So I think with that experience, I lean towards the Twins being able to just hold on to their lead and just kind of stick this one out. But I mean, even when you're looking at the Royals, I mean, for what the Royals did this year compared to last year, I don't know what their record was last year, but they're 82-69 now. That's a heck of an improvement from being 56-106 just about a year ago.
Absolutely.
And with not a ton changing either about their team, other than Bobby Witt Jr. just having the season of his life. It's exciting, you know. It's a new era for, you know, it's a new era for ball players, right? You're seeing Bobby Witt Jr. in his third season, I mean, in a home run derby, a two-time All-Star now. He's really leading this team. And, you know, we talk about it all the time about young guys, but third season, he's kind of looked at in that clubhouse as a bit of a veteran now, right? You still have Salvador Perez. Also, the pitching staff for the Royals has been absolutely fantastic. Cole Reagans, is he on the...
Yes, he's
on the Royals.
Fantastic. 3.2 ERA.
Yeah, he's been fantastic. Gosh, now I'm blanking on all these guys.
They've got Michael Wacha, who's, you know, kind of having
crazy.
A renaissance.
Yeah.
Seth Lugo having his best pitching, you know, season as a starter in a long time. And I think you mentioned it, the talent in the AL Central has kind of gone a little untalked about this year, but it's one of the deeper divisions in baseball after being one of those divisions that is kind of an afterthought year after year. It's like, one of those teams that aren't, you know, playing an incredibly exciting brand of baseball, whether that be the Twins or the Guardians, is probably going to come away with, you know, that division title. And then, you know, there'll be an easy out in the first round of the postseason is kind of, you know, the feel that I get from that division each year. But this year, I think you mentioned it, the depth of that division and just some of the fun players have kind of made it, honestly, probably the most exciting division in baseball this year. Just some numbers that I kind of wanted to touch on during this stretch. for both the Twins and the Tigers. That is kind of going to lead into a little bit of my answer to that question that I posed to you earlier, is that the Twins started off the season 70-53, and the offense was firing on all cylinders. That they had a bullpen that was, you know, 12th in ERA in baseball. But since then, Minnesota's bullpen has been by far the worst during this 27-game collapse. Now, I know that this is a rather, you know, off the wall stat, but bullpen win probability is a pretty good indicator of how your bullpen has been performing as of late. And they rank 30th in baseball since August 18th with a minus 2.75 bullpen win probability. For reference, the next closest team is at minus 1.28. So they're actually double that and way worse. Yikes. They have a 5.47 ERA. And just another note on that is that five times in the last 18 losses for the Twins, they have led in the seventh inning or later.
Oh, gosh.
So okay. That bullpen that I kind of heard as a strength, you know, that you think of guys like Griffin Jacks back there and, you know, Theobar and Yoan Duran and Brock Stewart and all these guys that have shut it down, you know, in the postseason, even in previous years, are just surrendering, you know, leads game after game. And this even includes Monday night when Griffin Jacks, you know, gave up that 2-run homer to Kyle Manzardo of the Guardians in the bottom of the eighth. It's kind of just been a microcosm for everything that's been going wrong in the past 3 or 4 weeks here. And to that point, the Tigers are surging. 23-10 in their last 33 games. They had a 4-run comeback on Monday against the Royals, and now they're only two behind the Twins in that loss column. Minnesota does have the tiebreaker, so it's kind of more like a 3-game lead. But I think with the Mariners kind of charging back a little bit here, showing some signs of life in that offense, and you know, the Twins kind of just scuffling on pretty much all fronts, that offense not really picking up the slack like they used to, and kind of, you know, relying on that bullpen a little too much. Now the bullpen faltering. The three areas, whether that be starting pitching, pitching in general, fielding and hitting, it seems like they've got, you know, one of those firing at all times, but they're not really able to get, you know, the three areas of the game on the same page at the same time.
Yeah, it's you, I mean, you made a really good point there, and I kind of want to expand on it because you nearly said it exactly what I was thinking. But as again we look ahead to the playoffs, right, this is when you're going to get the best baseball. This is when you're going to get those teams that have the best starting pitching, they have the best middle relief, they've got the best closers. You cannot afford to be inconsistent going into the postseason, right? Whether you end your season inconsistent or you go in and you're not really sure and you've got some holes. You know, obviously what we saw last year with the Texas Rangers, who ended the season on a really bad note before the postseason, then somehow they found this resurgence offensively and pitching-wise, was pretty spectacular. But again, you look at these teams like the Twins, like the Royals, like the Tigers, they're going to be going up against some of the best teams that have also guys that are experienced in the postseason too. And you can't afford to have, I guess, in the Twins scenario, in the Twins case at least, you can't afford to have a bullpen that is going to be this shaky this late in the season. It's not a good sign heading into it. Granted, there's still some time, but again, this is why postseason baseball, in my opinion, is probably my most favorite postseason of the four major sports, is just because every pitch matters, whether you're the hitter, whether it's from the hitter's perspective or the pitcher's perspective. Every pitch matters, where you pitch it, what pitch it is. If that guy's able to foul it off, if he check swings at it, then it's like, okay, you know, then what do I go with next? It feels like every pitch just has so much more added weight to it. And again, kind of, I've taken kind of the long way around, if you will. But again, it goes back to teams in the postseason can't afford to have holes. You got to be able to patch that up early, and especially when it comes to pitching, you got to be careful. So that is definitely a worry for the Twins.
And to your point exactly, I think that, you know, we've seen these key pieces of the Twins, you know, and Byron Buxton, Carlos Correa miss some time. You know, they just came back, you know, in the last week or so here, and I think Max Kepler is actually supposed to return soon. But to your point exactly, the pitches in the postseason are taken a whole lot more aggressively, mm-hmm. a whole lot more with thought and with the, you know, I think that once you get to the postseason, you need all three. You need to absolutely have confidence in all three facets of the game. And when you see a bullpen that's really scuffling like this, there's not a lot of time for them to have confidence in their stuff. There's not a lot of time for them to build, you know, that trust in, you know, the guys that they're going to need to have trust in those big moments. And so I think another thing that plays into this is just that drop off of the Twins lineup in this second half. We've always kind of known that the Twins have had these hitters that can go on these hot stretches, and you know, we've seen them put up runs in bunches. But I think something that's kind of going, you know, a little unnoticed is how drastic of a drop off it's been kind of for Royce Lewis since he's come back from that injury. I think in totality, the team has just kind of taken a step back, and some of those hitters that were kind of overperforming in the first half are almost underperforming. You look at a guy like Willy Castro, who had 119 OPS plus in the first half. He's sitting at a 74 second half OPS plus. Ryan Jeffers, 122 in the first half, 85 in the second half. Royce Lewis, 186 OPS plus, one of the best hitters in baseball in the first half. 91 OPS plus, that means he's about 10% below league average there. And then Jose Miranda just falling off a cliff. Yep. You know, he had that consecutive hit streak in his at-bats earlier in the season, 149 OPS plus in the first half, 64 OPS plus in the second half. So I think that, along with the fact that they haven't been able to really hit with runners on base, just a 700 OPS with runners on base, and then it only ticks up to about 750 with runners in scoring position. And so I just think that the fact that this Minnesota offense is so predicated on the long ball and slugging and less on getting on base, it might kind of go hand in hand with their inability to close out games in the bullpen. I think that the Tigers are really, you know, have a really good chance to sneak in through this cracked door that the Twins have left open here.
Yeah, and to your point, right? And I know this has almost become a bit of a Twins segment to a degree too, right? Like, but sticking with that, this what I'm about to say can still be, you know, it can still be applied to every other team. But when it comes to the postseason, it's not. I'm trying to phrase this right. I'm not going to say it's not about winning every game, but it's about winning the series, right? And I know that's like a yogiism, right? Oh, you know, you just got to win the series. Well, yes, because that's what you have to do. But the point I'm trying to make is early on in the wild card round, it's the teams that have the best 1-2 punch that make it through. You don't need to have the best starting rotation to get through the first bit of the postseason. But you've got to have a really strong 1-2 punch, because if you win the first game, great, you can have a chance to win game 2 out of 3. If you lose that, okay, now it's tied 1-1. You got to go to your third guy. But again, I'm probably doing a really horrible job at explaining this, but it obviously makes all the sense in my head. But in pitch with postseason pitching, it's just the one and two guys, I think, are the most crucial. And if you can go out there and set the tone that way and take some of that pressure off your offense, which I feel like most offenses anyways get a bit of a boost when you get to the postseason, just because of the postseason being what it is, right? That whole atmosphere. I mean, you see it in Philadelphia every year.
I think another point in that is more pitches in the zone,
yes.
more pitchers, to your point, trying to command every pitch and trying to, you know, make a hittable pitch, you know, to give their defense a chance. Yeah, to your point.
No, that's exactly where I was going, right? It's like a seesaw. It teeter totters, right? The more the pitchers try to perfect their stuff, the more they're going to leave something over the plate. The more they leave something over the plate, the more the offenses are going to spark. And then you got to kind of find that balance if you're a team to find the good pitching and to get your offense ready to go for a postseason run. But this, I think, is a really, really interesting race, not just because it's the AL Central, but just because of what these teams were last year and what they are now, right? The Twins being here again, is good for them. It shows that, hey, that wasn't just a fluke. Maybe this can be a trend for the Twins. Maybe they are going to be this team for a few years. It's great to see the Royals being in a place they are. It's great to see the Tigers in a place they are. A lot of young guys on that team that you know this team is going to try to build around, right? Tarik Skubal, what's his name? Jace Young, right? Mm-hmm. Riley Green is having himself a better season overall, right? Someone who's really struggled early on in his career, and it's still early, but you're finally seeing some of these pieces together. Who knows? Maybe get Spencer Torkelson to finally find his way eventually.
He's starting to heat up just a little bit now that he's been called back up, right? Exactly. To your point, these young guys in the Tigers, you know, organization have kind of rejuvenated it. They're calling up a lot of guys recently. You know, you see, you know, guys like Parker Meadows and guys like Colt Keith just making an impact. And I think that contributes to the overall just fun, you know, aspect of this AL Central, and just adds another young, fun team in the American League.
Yeah, it's been a very exciting season. Even as an A's fan, I can say it's been very exciting. I mean, I've thoroughly enjoyed watching. Again, I'll say it again: the likes of the Judges, the Shohei's, the resurgence of Chris Sale and the Braves. Chris Sale on the Braves, maybe not the Braves, but you know, the Mets are still the Mets. But you know, seeing then guys like, again, Skubal with the Tigers and then the Royals and all that good stuff, especially with the AL Central. It's been a great season, and I mean, we're priming ourselves for what should be and what will be a very exciting postseason. So really looking forward to it. Folks at home listening on the drive or at home, thank you so much for tuning in. Really appreciate it. We really appreciate all this continuous support, whether you guys are listening live or catching up on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. But we've had fun tonight. We've talked a little bit about everything. TCU football, college football, NFL football, and now a little bit more of the MLB, which we will definitely dive into much more as the postseason gets underway and as the end of the regular season comes to a close. But again, if you want to stay up to date with us here at Riff Ram Reviews, be sure to find and follow us on social media. That's on Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts at Riff Ram Review. Or you can tune in every Tuesday from 7 to 9 p.m. right here on 88.7 The Choice. That'll do it for us here in the studio. But for Luke Anderson, Seth Dowdle, and Jackson James, my name's Ian DePeach. Thank you so much for tuning in, and we will catch you all next time.